Welcome to the Grace Community Church Weekly Podcast. You can find us online at gracetl.org. You can also find us on Facebook at GCC Turtle Lake.
Well, January is almost over, and so is our series, our January series, 2017, your best year ever. We talked on the 1st of January, we talked about putting God first. Making sure that his priorities are our priorities, particularly in the use of resources and time. When we live with the wrong priorities of life, we simply won't experience the fulfillment and joy that God intends for us. And then we talked about forgiveness and the importance of having a spirit of forgiveness towards people who have offended us or hurt us or things of the past. So many Christians live limited lives because they hold on to these things of the past and they can't let go of them. And it's just like chains. I've never had to do this, but in some survival training and things like that in the military, they'll put weights on you and tell you to swim. And sometimes having forgiveness, unforgiveness in our life is kind of like that. It's putting chains on us and say, go swim. It doesn't work very well. And so simply forgiving, excuse me, I'm one of the folks that's been dealing with a little bit of sinus stuff going on. And so talking of, you know, just having the spirit of forgiveness. And what's really critical is to understand that you can be forgiving towards another person, even if that other person has never sought forgiveness. And so many people think, oh, I can't forgive Joe, or, you know, this thing happened when I was a kid, and I can't forgive that because that person's already died. They've passed on. So how can I forgive? And the answer is you can still have a spirit of forgiveness and release the chains that are holding you. And then we talked about connections, relationships, fellowship. God designed this thing called the church. And I'm not talking about this building. You know, English, we sometimes have limited language. And in our limited language, our limited vocabulary, we really confuse ourselves. Because we say, are you going to church? And that usually means, are you going to this particular building? But God's church is not a building, it's a people. It's the called out ones. He designed this thing called the church. And we cannot live according to our potential he has given us if we don't live in connection with others in the body of Christ. It's God's design to give strength both to the individual follower of Christ and to the whole body. We're having a potluck after service. Now, a potluck is not fellowship. And if you don't understand that, I'm a little behind in getting the CDs of my sermons, but wait a couple of weeks and then get my CD. A potluck is not fellowship, but a potluck is a wonderful way to develop the connections that are necessary for true fellowship. It's I don't understand it. It's not something that's just unique to the United States church. It goes all the way back to the New Testament. But there's this thing about food and fellowship. It really is. You know, the early church gathered together eating from house to house, and they had fellowship one with another. There's this thing about food and fellowship. And I've decided that it's really hard to have fellowship without food. And so potluck, it's a wonderful thing. Then last week, we took a bit of a break from the series and had our annual State of the Church meeting. If you weren't here, we handed out financial reports for 2016 and the budget for 2017. We talked about goals and mission and vision and all those kinds of things. And we have copies of the financial statements if you'd like to get one. Well, today we're closing the series with the topic of carpe diem. How many of you ever heard that term, carpe diem? What does it mean? Seize the day. Absolutely. Now, you might recognize the phrase, but do you have any idea where the phrase came from?
Ancient
Nope. I thought some of you might say Dead Poets Society, the movie, because that is a line from the Robin Williams film a few years ago, Dead Poets Society. But it's really part of a longer phrase written by the Roman poet Horace. And so now you know. Unfortunately, many people have totally misapplied the thought behind carpe diem. In fact, for some people, when they say carpe diem, it's sort of like this. It's, hey, bro, we've got a major exam tomorrow, but the snow's good. Let's go snowboarding. Carpe diem. And that's totally not what Horace meant. In fact, carpe diem is part of a longer phrase that would translate something like this: seize the day, trust the future as little as possible. In other words, whatever it is that you want to get done, do it now. The things that are important, do it now, because you can't trust the future. Paul addresses that same kind of thought in our text, Ephesians 5, 15, and 16. Paying careful attention, then, to how you walk, not as unwise people, but wise, making the most of the time because the days are evil. Making the most of the time. The King James Version renders this redeeming the time, and the idea of redeeming the time is actually a little closer to the original language than just making the most of the time. The term redeeming the time actually came from a marketplace term. And it meant either buy what is in the market in a present tense, in other words, go get it right now, or there was also the sense, and we get this in the King James, the redeem, buying back something that was lost. And so this idea of not just making the most of the time, but buying back your time is really something that intrigues me. The reason it intrigues me is because of all the things in the world that you might possess, time is the thing you cannot buy back. You simply can't. Now, don't raise your hands, but how many of you would agree that at least in some point in your life, you haven't used your time as wisely and productively as you might have? I can think of a lot of time I wasted. I'm a daydreamer, and particularly when I was a little younger, when I was in school, when I was bored, my mind would take off in directions, and it was one of the ways that I could deal with boredom, because I would just flit off in my mind. I didn't do well in algebra. It was one of those subjects that bored me, and so I spent a lot of time daydreaming. As it turned out, once I was in my early 20s, I discovered that really I liked things of science, but to do science you had to have a lot of math, and so I honestly topped out at algebra 2 in high school, and in Bible school we didn't have to take math, and then when I went back to a secular college, somehow I found a way to not take any math courses. And so I have a master's degree and a lot of other graduate education and have never had a college-level math course. I did take statistics and graduate statistics and about had a heart attack my first day of graduate statistics when the professor stood up and said, "I hope all of you have had calculus through at least differential equations." And I was going, "Oh, man, my high school algebra is not going to work." I spent way too much time daydreaming. I can think of a lot of opportunities that I've missed in my life because of inaction and sometimes fear. You know, there's some of you are in the Financial Peace University that we're doing in Sunday evenings, and we're Steve, Jamie, is Jamie here? He's teaching. If someone hasn't started, can they start? I mean, I know we're on week three, but okay. If you have ever struggled with managing your finances, Financial Peace University is an incredible way to get your finances in control. And if you're not signed up for that and are interested, Steve, raise your hand. Talk to Steve. The Financial Peace University. Dave Ramsey, who is the kind of the speaker and so forth of Financial Peace, has a very disciplined approach to money management. It starts with saving $1,000 as an emergency fund. Now, I have spent my whole life trying to be a prudent financial manager. I had a girlfriend in high school whose mother said that she was sure that I was Scotch. That was not a compliment. I didn't like to spend money. I always thought of good financial management as staying out of debt, particularly unsecured credit card type of debt. And for the most part in our marriage, Connie and I have done that. But what I didn't do was prioritize saving money. And so every time some crisis would come up, the car would break or something like that, I'd have to put it on the credit card and then play catch up. And we would scrimp and we would save and we would pay that credit card off as quickly as we could. And then I would wait for the next crisis. You know what? I cannot go back 40-some years and redo that. I wish I could. I wish I could go back to when I was in my late teens or early 20s and start saving. But you see, time is something we can't ever get back. You can take your chainsaw to the pawn shop for a month and then go buy it back. You can take your car to the car dealer, sell it, and then change your mind and buy it back. But time, you can't do it. Yesterday is gone, and no matter how much you might want to get it back, you can't. So how in the world can we do what Paul says to redeem or buy back time? And the answer is, in one sense, you can't. It's impossible. But when Paul tells us that, I think he's giving us a real important insight into how we ought to be living our lives and managing our times. I can't get yesterday back. It's gone. I can't get last week back. It's gone. I can't get last year back. It's gone. We're in 2017, and January is almost gone. I can't get any of that back. But what I can do is change how I'm living today so that God's priorities are being expressed in my life right now and in the future. So much of our time is wasted because we're simply not prepared for the opportunities that come our way. We can't seize the day because we're not looking for those opportunities. We're not preparing ourselves for them. Doors open and we're caught flat-footed, and before anything we can do anything that to walk through that door, the door closes again. To seize the day, you have to be ready. And I think it's the preparation, the readiness for opportunities, that really is what Paul is telling us to buy back the time. Because if I keep living my life, if I waste time and if I'm not prepared and I'm missing opportunities and I change nothing about how I'm prepared, then I will keep on doing that. So how do I buy it back? By changing the way I live right now. Jesus talked about this. He was talking to his disciples one day about a man that was lame from birth. The disciples got involved in this theological, philosophical discussion about why this man was lame. Was it because he sinned, or was it because his parents sinned? And they were all involved in this discussion. And Jesus just said, hey, listen, there's something way more important than why. What's way more important than the why he needs healing is he needs healing. And so Jesus just interrupted everything and he said, listen, this man is lame because God needs to be glorified. He's lame so that God can be glorified, and then he healed him. You find this statement of Jesus in the middle of this episode. We must do the works of him who sent me while it's day. Night is coming and no one can work. You see, what Jesus was really trying to tell the disciples was, carpe diem. Seize the day. There is this moment in time where this man needs healed, and so we're going to heal him. We're not going to have a philosophical, theological discussion about why he's sick. What they were actually doing was engaging in a theological debate that raged in Judaism for a couple hundred years, and that was the Jews had come to believe that anyone who had a significant illness or some sort of thing like that, it was always because of sin. We actually have some folks in Christianity today who teach very similar doctrine, and they totally ignore what Jesus said. He said, it has nothing to do with who sinned. It's so that God can be glorified. And here's the secret to seizing the day. The secret is that Jesus was ready to heal. He didn't have to think about it a whole lot. He didn't have to figure out the cause of the physical problem. He just healed the guy so that God could be glorified. The secret to seizing the day is looking for opportunities and being ready for opportunities for God to be glorified. I look at my own life and I know, I mean, I used to do a lot of traveling by air. And I'm an introvert. Now, some of you don't believe that, but I am. And it's actually very hard for me to engage in conversation with people I don't know. I work hard at it, but it's hard. And so my preferred method of traveling on airlines is to walk into the airplane, sit down, and erect an emotional wall around me that is so high and so thick that nobody can penetrate it. Leave me alone. I don't want to talk. I heard a similar sermon to this several years ago, and God began to convict me about that. And I began to look at all those airline trips I had taken, and I'm a big guy, particularly the ones in a middle seat. Yeah, that's really spirit. Have fun, those of you who are going to Haiti. And so I'm in the middle. I don't want to be in the middle. I never want to be in the middle. I want to be on the aisle so I can trip the flight attendants as they're going by, because I'm sitting like this with my back to my seatmates, my feet in the aisle. On this side of me is a woman who's way larger than me. On this side of me is a guy who doesn't understand anything about flying and protocol. And I'm going, leave me alone. Leave me alone. Just let me get to Atlanta, please. God began to convict me of that. Because that person and that person might be people who need Jesus Christ. And I'm not ready to seize the day. I'm concentrating on me. I'm uncomfortable. I hate it in here. I'm certainly making airline seats smaller every trip. What God is calling us to do is seize the day for His glory. Let's go back to Ephesians 5 and see what Paul has to say about how we can get away with the carelessness with which so many of us treat time. The first thing that he says is, pay careful attention. Some translations simply say, be careful. This is written in what's called the present imperative. And that's the important thing. Because the present imperative is right now, the imperative is a command, and there is always an understood subject. And the understood subject is you. I'm going to borrow you a minute. You, be careful. That's what Paul is really saying. He said, you, be careful. It's not a suggestion. It's a command. So first, we are to pay attention. Secondly, he says, what are we to be careful of? Be careful how you walk. Now, remember me daydreaming in algebra? I've been known to daydream as I walk. I've been known to daydream as I drive. When I was in Bible college, I went to Bible college in Florissant, Missouri, which is a suburb of St. Louis, north side of St. Louis. And I had a job at a jewelry store in Granite City, Illinois, on the other side of the Mississippi River. And it was 30 miles away or so. And my aunt and uncle lived another 30 miles beyond that and further into Illinois. And one day, I couldn't eat lunch at the school because I had to be at work before I was able to get lunch. And so I'd usually swing through McDonald's and get a cup of coffee and a hamburger. And so I'd head down the interstate, drank my coffee, lunch my hamburger. And when I didn't go to sleep, I just quit paying attention. And I was at the exit for my aunt and uncle. I'd gone 30 miles. And I didn't know it. I couldn't remember any of it. I blame the hamburger. I have been known. Hush. You know too many of my secrets. I did. I stepped off, and I was in London. And I stepped off into traffic, and fortunately, there was a London policeman, a bobby, who grabbed me by my coat collar and yanked me back because in my inattention I had forgotten that traffic goes the wrong direction. And so I kind of glanced the United States way. There wasn't anybody coming. See, that would be to my left, I guess. And stepped off as a car went shoop. You see, Paul says, be careful how you walk. And I know what it's like to not pay attention as I walk or I drive. But the walk that Paul is talking about is not a stroll down the street. It's not a stroll through the park. It's not making sure you don't step on the cracks in the sidewalk. He's talking about the journey of life. Be careful how you walk through life. You see, it's easy, just as easy as it is for me to forget about traffic's coming the wrong direction in the street in London, or forget about the fact that I was supposed to get off at the Granite City exit, not the Lebanon exit. As easy it is for me to forget about those things, it's just as easy to forget about the things that are truly important as I journey through life. The King James Version uses different, older, and frankly more elegant language. See then that ye walk circumspectly. There's a wonderful word, circumspectly. Charles Spurgeon, who was a great 19th century British pastor and preacher, commented on this passage, and here's what he wrote. And again, he's, you know, 19th century English, a little different, but pay careful attention to his words. He wrote, being careful to consider all circumstances and all possible consequences. Not carelessly, not thinking that it is of no importance how you live, but looking all around you, watching, lest even in seeking one good thing, you spoil another. I had a boss pretty early in my Air Force career that taught me a really important lesson that I remember to this day. I don't always live it, but I try. We had made some decision that made sense at the time, and then things sort of blew up, and my boss said, "Beware of the law of unintended consequences." And that's what Paul is really, part of what he's talking about is, you know, in everything that we do, there are intended consequences and unintended consequences. Spurgeon says that being careful to walk circumspectly is to think about, to pay attention to the consequences of how we're living. The other thought that Spurgeon offers that really struck me is the idea that when we seek something that is good, we might actually spoil something else. A man named Jim Collins wrote in a book that kind of became a management standard. It's called Good to Great. And he wrote this: good is the enemy of great. As we walk through life, it's easy to settle for good. I want a good marriage. I want a good business. I want a good living. And those are good things. But God desires greatness. Not necessarily as the world counts greatness, but He desires us to have greatness in our life. And when we settle for what is good, we miss the opportunity for great. Greatness in the kingdom of God has everything to do with God's glory. In the account of the lame man again, and this is really important, in the account of the lame man, you know, the disciples are arguing about, did he sin? Did his parents sin? Who sinned here? And Jesus interrupts all that and he says, no, you don't understand. This man is lame so that God can be glorified. Now understand, that man had been lame since his birth. He was fully grown. He was a man. He wasn't a boy. He wasn't an infant. He was a man. I'm not sure how old he was, but he was a man. He had been this way for a long time. And Jesus says, he is this way, he was born this way, so that God could be glorified right now. That messes with my head. God, you would let me experience difficulties in life so that you can be glorified? Absolutely. It messes with my head. It flies in the face of popular theology. But you see, the whole idea of seizing the moment, seizing the day, is where and how in my life right now can God be glorified? Let's say that you're struggling with something way more than the cold that Connie and I have been struggling with for the last few weeks. And I say way more than that because I know how miserable I've been with just a cold. I always admired Arlene Anderson because you would ask her, how are you doing, Arlene? I'm blessed. I'm blessed. Dave has taken that up since Arlene passed away a bit ago. Now, I knew Arlene, and I knew her well. And I knew many of the things that she was going through. And for her to say in that, I'm blessed, she was expressing the glory of God. I'm not a person that says that when somebody asks you how you're doing that you're supposed to lie. You know, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Sometimes we're not doing too good. And we need the support of our brothers and sisters in Christ. And we need to be honest. You know, right now, I'm not feeling real good. But do it in the context of God's glory. You know, I'm real struggling right now. My head feels like it's going to explode. There's been, you know, I can go on and on and on about how I felt in the last couple of weeks. And that's really minor compared to what some of you have experienced and are experiencing. But if we can put that in the context of, listen, I'm not feeling really good not right now, but here's what I know. God is being glorified in my life. You know, the Bible says that be thankful in all things. Really? My car's got a flat tire. I don't feel good. I forgot to pay the electric bill. I'm not having fun at work. And I'm supposed to be thankful? Yep. How come? Because that's what brings God glory. You see, when we look beyond ourselves and we begin pointing to Him, we bring glory to Him because that's not what the rest of the world does. So we can bring Him glory in the instant time that we're in simply by praising Him when we don't feel like it. That's seizing the day. It looks to me like, in the account of the lame man, that the disciples were ready to settle on good. Maybe throw a few alms in his basket and have this interesting discussion about who had sinned and then go about their business. Now, putting alms in the basket of a lame man is a good thing. It's commanded by God. We're supposed to take care of the poor and needy and the sick and the lame. In fact, Jesus says that when you fed the hungry, yeah, the judgment, he will say, when you fed the hungry, you were feeding me. When you clothed those who were naked, you were clothing me. When you visited people in prison, you were visiting me. And people will say, the disciples will say, well, when did we do that? And he will say, when you did it to the least of my brothers, you did it to me. And so that's a good thing. But Jesus went beyond good and he went for great. And he said, I'm going to heal this man so that God will be glorified. To seize the day, we need to take great care. We must be awake, alert, aware, to carefully consider the circumstances and look for the opportunities to bring glory to God. We can't separate religious life from the rest of life. And I think this is one of the traps that so many of us fall into. You know, we say, okay, it's Sunday. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to praise God. I'm going to worship God. I'm going to give my tithes. And then I'm going to go home, and that's where life is. But that's not where God has designed life with Him to be. It's not just when we gather together. It's 24/7. We can't separate religious life from the rest of life. We walk through life from the time we get up in the morning until we go to sleep at night. I've mentioned this before, but one of the most important things that I've done in my life, 20 years ago or so, I guess, was to write a short purpose or mission statement for myself. I was in my 40s. I was reaching the end of my Air Force career, and I was wondering what to do with the rest of my life. You know, one of those things, what do I want to be when I grow up? And some of the things I wanted to be, I had come to realize were not going to be possible. I still have the goal of being a fighter pilot one day. It isn't going to happen. But I took the opportunity to write this one line purpose statement or mission statement for my life. And I looked at 20 some years of being an adult, and I thought, what has been important to me over those years? What things have I done that have really brought me satisfaction and joy and fulfillment? And from that consideration, I actually took a few days of vacation time, which was rare for me, and began to consider that. And out of that, I wrote this. My purpose in life is to help others find and achieve their purpose in life. I looked at that as I had written it down and I said, wow, that sort of sounds like the job description of a pastor. I had been to Bible school. I had graduated from Bible school. I never thought I would. I didn't think I was capable of being a pastor. I actually had some designs at one point in my life of being on staff of a large church, but the idea of doing what I do now, I hadn't ever really considered that. I didn't think that was in the realm of possibility for me. But when I wrote that and I said, if this is my purpose in life, if this is how God wants to bring glory to Himself through me, maybe I need to think about doing something different than what I've considered in the past. And so I began to look for opportunities. I left the Air Force and God dropped a management consulting practice in my lap. And I was making way more money than I had ever thought about making. And it was fun and exciting and enjoyable and challenging, but it wasn't my life purpose. And so I had an opportunity to become the director of personnel for a Christian ministry in Colorado Springs. And it was something that made sense to me. It was called the Military Communities Youth Ministries. And they placed youth workers at military bases all over the world. And having just in the process of leaving the military, that made sense to me. And it wasn't going to be near what I was making my consulting, but it was something I looked forward to. And so we went to Colorado Springs. We looked at some property. We found 5 acres up in the mountain overlooking Colorado Springs and really excited about that. And the more I thought about it, the less satisfied I became because it wasn't going to fulfill my life purpose. And so one day, the senior pastor of First Family Church called me and said, we have a need on our staff. I can't pay you anything. And I called the director at MCYM and I said, would you allow me to withdraw from my commitment to MCYM because this opportunity to work with this local church is really what God is calling me to. I wouldn't have done that if I had not spent some time preparing and being ready for the opportunity. Sometimes I look back and then say, Ken, you were absolutely crazy. Arvid is out, and Arvid Moyne, our assistant pastor, is actually retired. He volunteers in the assistant pastor role, and he and his wife are out in Colorado Springs right now with their daughter. And so I talk to him occasionally, and he tells me, yeah, it snowed last night, but it's 50 right now. And I really think, Ken, what were you thinking? But this is what God has called me to. And had I not spent some time preparing and getting ready, I would have missed it. Seize the day. Now, why is it so important that we're careful as we walk through life? Well, Jesus says it's because the night is coming, and Paul says it's because the days are evil, and both of those things are absolutely correct, and each one by itself would be sufficient reason to take great care in how we walk through life. But let's start with Ephesians 5, the days are evil. The context of the two verses we read is a discussion that sort of, in a nutshell, would be, we who are serving God are children of the light. We are children of the light. We aren't part of the darkness. We're not part of the evil of the world. But the fact is, there is still great evil around us. We're not part of it, but it surrounds us. And sometimes, as children of the light, it's easy to forget that the days are evil. When I'm sitting in a deer stand, marveling at God's creation, even on opening day of deer season this year, I was in an open tripod stand. And for those of you who may remember being out hunting that day, the wind was blowing about 175 miles an hour. It wasn't quite that, but it was really high winds, and it was cold. And I was sitting in this tripod, and the tripod kept moving. And, you know, a gust of wind would hit, and one leg would sort of lift up a little bit. And I had all three legs pinned down, and I had staked them, but it would still kind of go like this and shift like that. And I'd go, oh, man. But as the sun came up, even with that gray, cold, windy day, I marveled at God's majesty of creation. And it's easy in those times to forget that the days are evil. It's sort of like the metaphor of a frog in the pan of water. How many of you have ever heard the frog in the pan of water? By the way, scientifically, it's not true. But it's still a great metaphor. The story is, and it's been told for a couple hundred years, and in the 1800s, they actually thought it was true. More recent research has proven that it's not true, but it kind of goes like this. You put a frog in a pan of boiling water, and it will try to jump out. You put a frog in a pan of cold water, put it on heat, and let that water heat up gradually, and the frog won't know it's boiling to death until it dies. And as I said, scientifically they've proved it's not true. But it's still used as a metaphor, philosophical metaphor, for something called creeping normalcy. Creeping normalcy. We begin to think that what is surrounding us in culture and society is normal. And so we don't pay much attention to it. But I want you to think about what our culture is like today and the things that we accept as normal that would have shocked us out of our boots 20 years ago. Things that we see on TV that would have shocked us, that would have horrified us 20 years ago. It's this thing called creeping normalcy. It happens gradually, and we begin to think, this is just the way things are. And so it's easy to forget that the days are evil, but they are. And Paul says, listen, you've got to walk circumspectly. You've got to walk carefully. You have to pay attention because the days are evil. Two reasons for that. Number one, we have to walk carefully because the days are evil because it's easy to get sucked into that ourselves. It's normal. Ken's very loose translation of Romans 12, 1. Don't be conformed to the world's way of thinking, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. Don't be conformed to the world's way of thinking. What does the world think about the necessity of gathering together with God's people on a regular basis? The world doesn't think it's important. Statistically, the majority of Christians don't think it's important. But God says it is. Don't be conformed to the world's way of thinking. There are so many ways that without ever considering it, without being, if we're not careful, we can begin to conform to the world's way of thinking. What does the world say about the money that comes into your life that you earn? Whose is it? Well, I earned it, it's mine. What does God say about that? God says it's mine. You see, it's easy to get sucked into the world's way of thinking. And the world is increasingly evil. So the first thing that we have to do is be careful in how we walk so we don't get sucked into the world's way of thinking. The second reason it's important to walk carefully. Because the days are evil, it's because our job is to push back the darkness. How do we push back the darkness? How does that happen? Two ways again. First, by letting God's love shine brightly in our own lives. And then, by introducing those who do not know Him to Jesus Christ. You see, the darkness gets pushed back one person at a time. Be careful how you walk because the days are evil. You bet you, and it's increasingly evil, so I need to pay attention to allow God's love to and light to shine brightly through me and look for those opportunities. I'm sitting in the airplane.
Leave me alone. Just leave me alone.
And a young man gets on. He stumbles his way past me. I'm in the two-seat row. I'm on the aisle, fortunately. This young man comes in, sits down by the window. I look at him. He does not look like me. At that point, I had a portable CD player and a pair of headphones. He looks at me and says, "Oh, you got your tunes, man." "Sure, dude." He pulls out a little thing that I had never seen before. It looked like a cigarette lighter. He's got earbuds plugged into his little cigarette lighter. I didn't know what it was. Some of you still don't know what it is. Well, I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, I forget what he called it, but yeah, it was probably MP3 player or something." I said, "So, how many? What can you? That doesn't look very big. You going to make it through the flight before you run out of songs?" He said, "Oh no, man." He said, I got way more on this than you've got in that CD." So we began to talk. He didn't look like me. Had a lot of tattoos. Strange piercings in all sorts of places. Probably didn't see them all. But that day, got out of this. And I paid attention. "So, where are you going?" He told me where he was going. I said, "Oh, you got family there?" He said, "No." He said, "My family's sending me to rehab." We talked for a while. And he pulled a little tin out of his pocket and opened it. And I could see there were some pills in there. I said, "So are you going to get high one last time before you go to rehab?" He said, "Well, yeah, that's my plan." I said, "Do you want to get clean?" He said, "Honestly, I don't know."
I began to talk to him about Jesus. I have no clue if that young man is still alive. I don't know. But I know I was aware enough that time to be able to tell him about the one person in life who could change his life. I wonder how many times I missed. How many people did I sit next to, huddled into my, please don't bother me, all I want to do is get to the next place, and totally missed it. We have to walk carefully to seize every opportunity to bring God's light into the darkness of the world. The other reason, and Jesus said, the night is coming. And it is. The night is coming when no man can work. I saw this week that you've probably heard of the doomsday clock. They folks, and I don't know who runs it, but some scientists that will reset the clock, how close we are to nuclear holocaust. They reset it this week. About 2 minutes closer. I don't know if the night is coming because of the nuclear holocaust or if the night is coming because Jesus is returning, but here's what I know. The night is coming. A friend of mine, a pastor, recently made the comment that he believes that God has, in the United States, opened a window of opportunity for Christians. You know, we've lived in a culture for several years where we as Christians were being told by those who are not committed believers that we were supposed to keep our mouths shut, that we shouldn't be out there sharing the good news, that somehow is politically incorrect and all of that. And my friend said he believes that God has opened a window or a door for a time. And I believe that too. I just don't know how long that is. For a time, Christians in our nation may be able to do God's work. For a time, we may be able to speak His word freely. But the pressure to conform to the world's way of thinking is still there. I just read this week another online article, and it wasn't an old article, it was a current article, that addressed many of the social issues of the day, and then the author of the article made this statement. Evangelicals are the problem, and they are the enemy. That's pretty heavy pressure. You see, night is coming when no man can work. And we need to be careful and pay attention so that we can work while it is yet day. Seize the opportunity to do God's work and to bring Him glory. My music instructor in Bible school wrote a song in 1973. And yes, I know that's ancient history. But this song was called Only One Life. If you were a Christian in 1973 and paying attention to popular music, you may have actually heard it. It was on the Christian music billboard, you know, top 10 songs kind of thing. The chorus goes, only one life, so soon it will pass. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one chance to do His will. So give to Jesus all your days. It's the only life that pays. When you recall, you have but one life.
We hope you enjoyed today's message. You can find information and our sermons online at gracetl.org. Thanks for listening.